This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is a special podcast edition of the New Yorker Radio Hour. Today we're sharing one of our favorite summer stories from 2016.
All right, I'm going to put this in real quick.
This week's show comes with a warning. If a beautiful afternoon on a beautiful river sounds good to you, it just might make you jealous. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Today we're going out on the Yellowstone River, some of the best trout water in the country, with two great writers, an old master and a rising star. Thomas McGuane, the elder by 40-some years, has written novels, screenplays, short stories, and some great essays about the outdoors. The very first book by Callan Wink, a collection of stories, came out just this year. In season, he works as a fly fishing guide in Livingston, Montana, and on one of his rare days off this summer, Callan took Tom out on the river.
Callan, have you got any stories coming up? I really love the two that I read in The New Yorker.
Oh, thanks.
And you young whippersnappers who go on and worked for you because you did a great job, but I just hate seeing these really good short story writers turning into novelists.
Well, I'm trying to do that, and it's a struggle.
Well, you know, I the reason I feel that way is that the American short story is getting radically better than it's ever been, and the novel's getting radically worse than it's ever been.
Yeah? Well, do you like to read short stories?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I give you a better answer to that. I can do it if I'm kind of doing it all the time.
Yeah.
But if I do it sporadically, they just don't involve me enough.
Yeah, that's kind of how... I mean, I enjoy writing them. I don't particularly enjoy reading them. You know, if you want to write what you read, like I like to read novels, so I really want to write a good one.
Yeah.
You know? And so I'm going to keep plugging away at it, I guess, so I do. But you can get in the front there, Tom.
Here, more or less?
Yeah. You're in.
Really a modest mess. What do we got here? Oh, good.
So you've got the big dry and then the big nymph below it.
Okay.
So,
All right.
It should be fun to cast for you.
That's great.
Tom McGuane and Callan Wink are separated by more than four decades in age, but they've got quite a bit in common. They both grew up in Michigan. They both worked as fishing guides. They both adopted Montana as their home, and they both write fiction, thankfully, for The New Yorker. And right now, they're both in a 15-foot drift boat with a couple of fly rods and a box of tackle, which sounds like a little bit of heaven to me right about now.
Oop. I don't know what that was.
That one looked kind of good. We're not exactly lighting them up here this morning, Tom.
That's all right.
I can't believe we haven't gotten a eat on that nymph yet. If we go another half mile with no action, we're going to have to reconsider our lives here.
Sort of sounds like fishing to me.
Mm-hmm.
How's the fishing been this last early season? It's just really getting going, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's just been getting going. It cleared early this year. We didn't have our normal long runoff. You see the water is still, it's still a little up and slightly cloudy here. The Yellowstone is interesting in that it doesn't, it never runs perfectly clear like some other rivers you see. Because it is the longest undammed river in the lower 48, I think. It always carries some sediment in the flow.
With lots of headwaters that can blow out individually. Yeah, yeah. They all have a little different color, too.
Yep, that's exactly right. When it's brown, that comes from the Lamar. When it's just kind of milky green, that's from the Gardner, generally. Right. Okay, so.
Oh, we got a little.
Little split shot, little rubber leg, woolly buggers thing. They were eating that yesterday pretty well. Again, we were fishing it under an indicator yesterday, so a little different presentation, but if you just kind of cast towards the bank and give it a slow strip, we'll see what happens.
We'll do.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm pulling together my collected stories for the fall. Knopf's going to publish them in the spring. And I've started a novel. It's been kind of an interesting, you know, at this age, I partly don't really want to get obsessed with something for 3 or 4 years. You know, there's too many, I like the world too much.
Yeah.
And, but I'm sort of heading that way. And I've started this novel that sort of combines some of the stuff about my life when I was living in Key West and guiding part-time. And it was an unbelievable era for those of us who were there then. And then I really never written much about my family, you know, or my growing up and stuff like that. And I've sort of found a way to include it in that story. I come from a remarkably dysfunctional family, and they were so spectacularly dysfunctional, I never could figure out how to write about them. It's not close enough, is it?
No, it's perfect.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
okay.
Get in there too far, it's just gonna get snagged. That one might have been a trout. I'd take a whitefish right now, Tom. I mean, that's where I'm at right now.
You're worried about more than I am. I'm just thinking about writing. I have to make sure I pay attention. It might be.
Are you on the everyday program right now?
No, not really. Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah, I feel like when I have a good stint of doing it a lot, then it just all becomes easier, you know?
Oh,
but
that's
when
absolutely
you've
right.
Taken a month off, like I basically do guiding, even a couple months.
Very hard to do.
Know,
it.
Then it's just a torturous process to get back anything in shape for writing. At least for me.
I think, you know, that is the best reason for having regular work hours is just to not beat yourself up when you try to start up again.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess when it comes down to it, there does need to be. Ooh, there it is. Oh man!
I fired one off.
Heartbreak.
That was a little guy, I think.
Yeah, that's what we'll tell ourselves.
We want anything though, right?
And then, do you ever just get one that just comes out? Like it comes out.
Almost
finished. You know.
Yep. Every now
and then you're like, how did that happen? Yeah, how can I do that again?
And I know. You just keep maneuvering, hoping you'll get your head in a place to do that. I always think of this thing I remember reading long ago. It's been in my mind a lot, where Chekhov is off in his summer dacha, and he's writing a story, and he's almost done with it, and this thunderstorm comes up, rainy thunderstorm, blows all his papers out into the yard and rains on him. And he was nearly finished with the story. And his house guest said, you know, it's not a big problem. You just finish, just go while it's fresh in your mind, go back and write it again. Chekhov said, I don't remember anything about it. I thought that's really a true story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've had one kind of disappear into the nether world of the internet, or the, you know, my computer.
Kiss
it
goodbye, right?
And it was just like, I was pissed about that for days.
I'm sure. Well, you know, John Cheever said that all fiction writing is basically improvisatory. And I agree with that, you know.
Yeah, it seems like quite often when I get to the end of a first draft, I have to go back and, like, redo the whole beginning because it was starting off in a certain way, like I had an idea.
Right.
And then, a page or two in, the story is completely taken.
It almost makes you feel you don't need an idea. You just need to go to work.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and that's kind of what I strive to do. I'm not always good at it, but just starting with something.
I think the kind of waiting for a good idea is one of the many subtle forms procrastination takes.
Yeah, definitely.
Or not even waiting for one, or just even the belief that you need one is in itself procrastination.
Yeah, it's true, and that's what makes, when you're not writing, makes you feel so guilty.
Oh, yeah.
At least I'm speaking of me personally.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Well, I'm at 76, that's exactly how I feel. If I don't write, I just feel like my life is, just I'm throwing it away.
That's amazing. You still have the
maybe
burn
more than,
to do it. I mean,
yeah, I really do. Maybe more than ever.
I hope I still have some of that left. Oh, there's one.
We'd had enough, hadn't we, Kellen?
I was just going to sit here until you hooked one, basically, so I'm glad it happened eventually.
That's a nice fish.
Real nice. They're strong down here. I mean,
yeah, they are.
A little rainbow, but little, they...
I know. It's got plenty of
yeah, they're
healthy. Boogie. They're strong down here. They must not have learned the catch and release routine here.
No, they're... I mean, there's not a mark on this fish.
Yeah, pretty good. Good one. Thank you. I've been living on a ranch of some kind or another for over 40 years, and for a long time running a lot of cattle, and if you were in the house, you were a shirker.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's, I would sneak to do my writing where no one could catch me at it. It was like I had some kind of sick masturbating habit or something, I think that was one of the reasons I got so into kind of rodeo type stuff, It was like build up my legitimacy with these people. I could say, oh, he's in the house all weekend, but he won the roping.
Yeah.
And then that was okay.
Oh, there's one. Yeah, I mean, they kind of, I don't know if you feel like you got, I mean, kind of the brand as a Western writer. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I know, and I don't really want that brand.
Yeah, yeah. It's look, what is Western writing?
I know. It used to be, even in my years in the West, it used to be a lot of writers who were local writers, like Ivan Doig and Mary Clearman Blue and.
Keep going left here.
Bill Kittredge,
uh-huh.
All these people. A lot of what they wrote was almost like land claiming, It's what I call prior appropriation memoirs, Mary Clearman Blue's stories about my grandpa was here in 1890. Or,
uh-huh.
I remember the five bottom plow and the old. And it was, she's a good writer and stuff like that, but it was all about, a kind of ersatz nativism that I found kind of tiresome.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, even Wallace Stegner was kind of complaining that the Western literature was all sort of historical, it was, only to like 5% of Montanans are ranchers. But there's been a feeling for a long time, it's all your stories supposed to be kind of ranch stories. And there's just, you never meet people of the kind in Western fiction. It's changing, but you never would meet anybody in Western fiction that resembled anything like the people you knew in Western towns, which are like like people everywhere else. But that's changing. But it is considered a, you know, violating the myth.
There he was.
That was a...
Got a little cloud cover all of a sudden. Yeah, he might start actually biting. Well, that's good. You got a look on that top fly.
Yeah, I know. I need to be looking when it was looking.
That was always Jim's classic move, looking for his cigarettes.
Yeah.
You know, that's when he'd get one.
I know. God, what a cigarette habit he had.
Why don't you hit that to the right here? Just right out to the middle.
Okay. I knew Jim Harrison from the time we were in school together, and he had this unusual charismatic personality. And was a real, real driven lover of everything about literature. He was an irresistible guy. But he also, in addition to being so artistically inclined, he loved the outdoors and loved to hunt and fish. So anyway, we got along immediately and stayed in touch all our lives, really.
I grew up reading him because... He lived in Michigan, was born very near where I was born, actually, and so my dad was always a big fan. We had some good times on the river, you know. I'd take him a handful of times every summer, and, you know, with Jim, like, the fishing was of marginal importance, but he would call me several times the night before we were supposed to go to make sure that I remembered the salt for the chicken thighs and the hot sauce and the hot peppers and, you know, things like that. That's where his main concerns were around what we were going to have for lunch.
And, yeah, I know. That was
making sure that I didn't
crazy
forget
about
it.
Him.
Yeah.
You could be in a lot of fish and have to go eat.
Yeah.
That's great.
So, should have saved some of the voicemails he left me. I mean, they're just classic. And he would always, he'd always call and be like, "Hey, this is Jim Harrison," like full name. Like,
yeah.
I couldn't I know. Recognize who he was. You know?
Right. That's funny. That's a good point. Well, you know, he was so unlike anybody will ever know. That, you know, his absence is pretty powerful, isn't it? Really.
Yeah. I mean, it's. He's just kind of always been around, been Jim, you know. Like it's kind of surprising to.
But not having Jim to write to is a hardship. But I have to be honest about that.
Yeah, I mean, how often were you guys writing?
Every week, at the least.
That's amazing.
But usually more than that.
Yeah.
And not always consequentially. It's just, you know, I always felt like I had something in my mind.
Yeah.
Often something nobody else would be interested in, you know, or
sure.
get. Yeah, just drop it up to the gym.
Well, that's just a cool collection of letters. I mean,
yeah.
You know, that people are going to want to read those.
I'm going to edit mine with a heavy hand. I said a lot of disreputable things in my day I want to talk about.
Okay, swing that left now. I mean, those are all the things everyone's going to want to read. Do you realize that?
Yeah, right? I know.
All right, go left here.
Over here?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and he, I mean, Harrison, you know, he's a rascal, you know. And,
yeah.
I mean, for example, I was working on this story one time, Harrison... looked at it, he liked the title, so he just took it. Legends of the Fall.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I had never heard that.
Yeah.
That was your title.
That was my title.
Oh, that's classic.
What he did with it was way more than what I was going to do with it, so it was okay with me.
Yeah, that one you kind of have to be like, well...
Yeah, no, that was worth it.
Give that one up. That's still a great book. I mean, I reread it last year. I mean,
it was good.
Extremely good.
And full of emotion.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much cold, well-done stuff out there. Mm-hmm. That's something that really gives you heartaches. It's kind of rare.
Nearing the end here. The end is nigh.
Geez, this has been a nice little jaunt.
Caught a couple fish. No one fell in.
No one fell in.
I used to always say that at about this point in my day. Like, oh, you know, good success. We caught some fish. No one fell in. And then, of course, at one point, after I had said that, between like here and the boat launch, a guy fell in. You know, like after I made my statement, I was like, I got to stop saying that until we're in the car.
It's what I hear over in my county. You'll say to people, you say, how are the kids? And they'll say, well, nobody's in jail. It's just like, it's the basics.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, can't expect too much more than that.
You really can't. Callan Wink and Tom Egwene. You can find some of their stories at newyorkerradio.org. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much and see you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Toon Yards with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.